unfortunate that you didn't have biochemistry before me, but that's the way it goes sometimes. A lot of my integrations involve all subjects. You know, farm, you've already seen some farm, you've seen some histo, you've seen a lot of biochemistry, and you've seen some physiology already. So actually, you understand a little bit better if you've had those things before, and they can't always stick me at the end of every single board review. There's other ones around the country that I have to do. And so it's unfortunate. Those that have had biochemistry before, you're able to follow me a little bit better on these things. But these things will begin making more sense when you have your biochemistry. In terms of keto acid synthesis and fatty acid synthesis, you're probably a little bit weak on this. I'm actually writing a book on biochemistry with another guy. And so I'm kind of up on this right now because I just finished doing this stuff in the book. Okay, so I have an advantage in that I'm pretty up on this stuff at this particular time. In fact, I finished the last chapter yesterday on the plane, which was held up. I'm showing another. What is this? This is the liver. It's fatty change. So which of these two kids has the fatty change? The one on the right, because the one on the right has? Kwashiorkor. Big deal. What's the mechanism? Okay, I'm going to give you a hint. When you make VLDL and you want to get it out of the liver, don't you have to put a protein around the outside of it? Yes or no? What do we call those proteins? Apoproteins. That's your hint. What's the problem in kwashiorkor? A decrease in protein intake. They have an adequate number of calories, but it's all carbs. And so they can't get the VLDL that they make in the liver out of it because they have no apolipoprotein to cover it and put it out into the bloodstream and solubilize it in water. See, lipids and water don't mix. You all know that. And so you have to put protein around a lipid for it to dissolve in water. Okay, so that's why the big protuberant abdomen that kids with kwashiorkor have is due to two reasons. One, that decreased protein, which decreases oncotic pressure, and you get ascites. That's one reason. But the biggest reason is they have huge livers related to fatty change. And the mechanism of this is different than an alcohol. In alcohol, it's related to increasing synthesis of the LDL from the mechanisms we just talked about. In this case, it's due to lack of protein. That to put around the VLDL to get it out of the liver. And so that's the reason for the fatty change here. So mechanisms. Okay, there's a whole section in there that I'm not talking about, that one that it deals basically with hemosiderin. The section, this has nothing to do with hemosiderin, so don't look at this and think about where's the hemosiderin. There ain't any. It's calcium up there. The discussion that I'm not going to do right at this point is dealing with hemosiderin and ferritin. All I'll basically say at this point is that ferritin is a soluble form of circulating iron. That's a wonderful marker for your iron, the amount of iron you have in your bone marrow. Would be the test of choice for diagnosing any iron-related problem like iron deficiency, anemia, chronic disease, or iron overload diseases like hemochromatosis, hemosiderosis, get a serum ferritin. It'd be elevated. In the iron overloads, it'd be decreased in iron deficiencies. That's a soluble form of iron storage. Hemosiderin is an insoluble form, and it's usually stored in macrophages in the bone marrow. That's all I'm going to say at this point. You can stain it with a stain called Prussian blue, and it'll show up. Now, so let's do this. Types of calcification. We have two types, dystrophic and metastatic calcification. Now, dystrophic, what's this mean? Abnormal. Dysmenorrhea, you know, painful abnormal menses. Dyspnea, difficulty breathing. Dysphagia, difficulty swallowing. Then you have to decide whether it's solids, liquids, both, whatever. Okay, so dystrophic means abnormal calcification. It means that you've had damaged tissue and it gets calcified. Whenever you have any damaged tissue, calcium can calcify it. You played football, you got a big giant hematoma in your thigh, let's say. You had a good chance of that getting calcified. Dystrophically, the calcium will bind into that and produce calcium deposits. Now, you saw an example of dystrophic calcification already. Could you please tell me what it was? was enzymatic fat necrosis. Remember I showed you those little chalky areas? That's a good example of dystrophic calcification. Okay. The serum calcium is totally normal, just that you damage tissue, and calcium loves to calcify damaged tissue. Happens in an atheromatous plaque, too. A lot of the real, really serious damage in atherosclerosis is the dystrophic calcification part of it. And that's what makes them so hard to dissolve. The only way you can get rid of dystrophically calcified blood vessels is to be on an incredible diet called the Ornish diet. And you can actually reverse calcified atheromatous plaques with that diet. But boy, you've got to be some kind of unbelievable. I mean, that's purest of the pure veggie and diets that exists. But you can't reverse it. But calcium does a bad job on your vessels. Okay, so this is an example of dystrophic calcification. It's also the most common cause of aortic stenosis, because this is aortic valve. It's also the most common cause of a certain type of hemolytic anemia, which we'll discuss when we get to it. Is anything abnormal with these valves? How many valves should you have in aorta, guys? 3. How many do you see? 2. So 2 are doing a job of 3, huh? And so because 2 are doing the job of 3, they get damaged. And they get dystrophically calcified. That's what this is right here. And it narrows the orifice of the aortic valve, producing aortic stenosis. Okay. Right now, we're interested in just recognizing processes now. We do aortic stenosis again when we get to the systems. A lot of you running up here, you know, and I mention a lot of these things in advance, but then we go through systems and we hit these things again. Right now, you're getting the vocabulary that you're going to need to go through systemic pathology. Okay. A lot of times we'll give you some advanced information, which we go over again. Now, sometimes if you have hypercalcemia or hyperphosphatemia, either one, calcium could be actually made to deposit in normal tissue. That hasn't been damaged. Could you please tell me, if someone had hypercalcemia in this room right now, what would you have? What would be the cause of it? Primary hyperparathyroidism would be the most common cause of hypercalcemia in us here. But what if we were in a hospital right now, we got a consult to work up hypercalcemia, what would it be? Malignancy-induced hypercalcemia, that is correct. Because you have hypercalcemia, you can actually put calcium in normal tissue. That's called metastatic calcification. Dystrophic, it's damaged tissue with a normal serum calcium. Whereas in metastatic calcification, it's a high calcium or high phosphorus. Now, some of you may not know, but when you deposit calcium in bone, it's the phosphorus part of the solubility product that drives calcium into bone. So if you have high phosphate levels, very dangerous, because it'll take calcium and drive it into normal tissue. That's why when they have renal failure and they have high phosphate levels in renal failure, they have to dialyze off the phosphate, because that phosphate is going to be driving calcium into normal tissue, like your heart, your conduction system there, into renal tubules and the basement membrane, that's called nephrocalcinosis, and damage things. So dystrophic and metastatic calcification, two terms that you need to know. Most of the time we're going to be dealing with dystrophic calcification. I just picked this one to show you. So this is a congenital bicuspid aortic valve, is the most common cause of aortic stenosis in the United States. Should have 3 valves, only have 2, they get damaged because they're doing all the work. Okay, anything abnormal with this smear? Say yes. Okay, now this is dealing with a defect in the cell membrane. Name it spectrin. This is spherocytosis. Okay, if you can't see a central area of pallor, guys, it's a spherocyte. If you can't see a central area of pallor, like a donut, it's a spherocyte. Now you'll see why when we do hematology. That's tomorrow. We'll start it. But I want to just mention it now when we talk about cell membrane defects, which is part of this particular chapter on cell injury. There's one of the classic cell membrane defects is the absence of spectrin in the red blood cell membrane, causing the red blood cell not to be able to form a biconcave disc. You need spectrin in order to keep a biconcave disc. If it's defective, then it forms a sphere, that cell. That's the defect that you want to remember. Spectrin, spherocytosis. In fact, they both begin with SP. Okay, spectrin, spherocytosis. Okay, Arnold Schwarzenegger will probably be in this movie, although I hear he's trying to get out of that role model, you know, for destroying everything. And it's going to be called the Ubiquinator. And this is the concept here of ubiquitin. Ubiquitin is a stress protein, probably in us right now, maybe you more than me. I'm not as stressed probably as you. Your ubiquitin levels are pretty high. It's a stress protein. And if some of your intermediate filaments, which you should know what they are, intermediate filaments are things like keratin, desmin, vimentin. These are part of the superstructure of our cells that keep our cells, you know, from collapsing on themselves and being one big protoplasmic mass. Okay, they're called intermediate filaments. Okay, they're like the frame of a house that upon which the building is made. We have intermediate filaments are the frame upon which things are built for a cell. When they get damaged, then the ubiquinates it. Okay, in other words, marks it for destruction. That's where Arnold Schwarzenegger comes in, because he goes around and looks for all those intermediate filaments, and he sees those that have been tagged, ubiquinated, and destroys them. And some of these ubiquinated products have names, actually. This one is a liver. Now, fatty change and alcoholism is as simple as if you can recognize a open space and you know it's liver tissue, what do you think it is? It's a fatty liver. Okay. I mean, that this is not for pathologists, this exam. This is for second-year medical students. Okay, so if you got a liver and you see a space is in it, that's fatty change. And if you play odds on it, always play the odds alcohol. Okay, so you see a space here. So what does that mean? Fat, which means alcohol. Therefore, these pink things that you see here probably are the pathology, and they probably have an arrow to them. These are called Mallory bodies, and that's an example of ubiquinated. That the filament that's damaged is keratin. And so it forms what are called Mallory bodies, which we use histology to say, hey, this patient has alcoholic hepatitis. We see these Mallory bodies here in fatty change. So that actually has a name that helps us. Okay, so Mallory bodies are an example of an ubiquinated neurofilament. Now, this one's been asked on boards a lot. This is a silver stain. These are neurofibrillary tangles. Okay, and it was a tricky question. I had to look it up because I did not know the answer when I heard about it on a student's exam. I thought they were going to put it in the context of Alzheimer's disease where it's loaded, but neurofibrillary wasn't one of the choices. Okay? I came down to two diseases. I think one was Huntington's chorea, and the other one was Jakob-Kutzfeld disease. They were the only two that I could narrow it down to. The other ones clearly weren't associated with neurofilaments. Turned out that Huntington's didn't, but in Jakob-Kutzfeld you can form neurofibrillary tangles. So you will see that listed in one of your high yields there. That was very tricky, very unfair, but that's the way the game is sometimes. Okay, so you're not always going to get the 99 percentile on this test. They're always going to throw in something to ruin your perfect score. Okay, and so that's how they tried to do that. But you know what's interesting? A lot of those things that they ruin people's perfect scores with are in your high yield. Whoa. So that decreases the that decreases their chance of getting you, doesn't it? Yeah, I think so. Remember the tau protein? The tau, T-A-U protein, is associated with neurofibrillary tangles. Well, that's an example of an ubiquinated neurofilament. Okay? And this one here is a, well, you tell me, you had neuroanatomy. Is that pigment? Yeah. So what do you think this is? Substantia nigra. What do you think disease we're talking about? Parkinson's, there you go. And here's a little inclusion. Some of you thought that was a nucleus. They're not red color, they're blue color. That is an inclusion called a Lewy body, seen in Parkinson's disease. What's the neurotransmitter deficient here? That's on every board. Dopamine, there you go. Dopamine, okay. So the Lewy body is an example of an ubiquinated thing. So a couple interesting things here. Of course, this is also a neurofilament that's been damaged. So we have neurofibrillary tangles, Lewy bodies, and Mallory bodies, all an example of ubiquination. Now, this is big, 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 big. I can't say it. Big times to the 10th power. Important. Okay? You've got one sheet of paper. that has it all. But before we do, cell cycle, which you already should have had. This should not be new stuff. You did have cell biology, did you not?
I don't know. How do you spell that?
Well, it's cell biology. We had it, I hope, cell cycle. Okay, all right. But before we do this, let's make sure you know the three types of cells, which is histology. One, you have a cell that is, what I'm blocking on it, stable. What'd you say? Labile. I knew that. Okay. Labile cells or label cells. What does that mean? It means it's a cell that the division is via a stem cell. Okay. I said stem cell, now you start talking to me. Name three tissues that have stem cells. Bone marrow, skin, basement membrane of skin. Remember, germinal cell or basement membrane layer. Three, the crypts, the base of the crypts in the intestine. All have stem cells in them. And they have a tendency of being in the cell cycle a lot. So you had pharmacology, and you knew about, you know, a lot of drugs that are cell cycle specific and some that are cell cycle nonspecific. Recall? So what do you think would be those cells most affected by those drugs? The label cells that are in the cell cycle the most, right? And so isn't it true that most of the time when you had Trevor? Okay. God, somebody in here isn't Trevor? I don't know. I've never heard of him. Okay. And that was that guy that says he's from England. Okay, but he's from England, Arkansas. We all know that. We know that fake accent of his. He's a fake. I'm just trying to expose him. He's basically trained over there with Kreb. He got that little English dialect, which made him sound a lot smarter than where he's really from, England, Arkansas. Okay? And then he tries to pass it off like he's British. Right. Okay. We're good friends, by the way, so don't worry about it. He knows about this. I always do this. Okay. Does it make sense that when you talk about bone marrow suppression with these different drugs that block the cell cycle, doesn't that make sense you get bone marrow suppression since there are stem cells there? Okay. Diarrhea, mucositis, and all that kind of stuff, doesn't that make sense? Aren't there stem cells there? And all these kinds of rashes that occur on the skin, and then also, what was the other one? We had the GI tract diarrhea. Don't they get diarrhea all the time? Aren't there stem cells there? So there's nothing magic about those complications, are there? Because they have stem cells. And those cells that are in the cycle the most are the ones that would be most affected by cell cycle specific or non-specific drugs. That makes sense? So we have label cells and we have stable cells. Stable cells are in the GO phase. They're in the resting phase. Most of our parenchymal organs, liver, spleen, kidney, in terms of muscle, only smooth muscle. The other muscles are not stable cells. Stable cells will do the division, but most of the time they're resting in a GO phase and something has to stimulate them to get into the cell cycle and divide. Okay, it could be a growth hormone, it could be some kind of hormone that does it, like estrogen, for example. If a woman in the proliferative phase of her menstrual cycle, then her endometrial cells would have been initially in a GO phase, and then when estrogen came up, it stimulated the GO cells to go into the cell cycle. Okay, so that would be the stimulator for it. Most of the time, it's some kind of growth factor or hormone. So they can divide, but most of the time, they have to be invited to do that by some hormone or growth factor. Those are stable cells. Permanent means they can no longer get into the cell cycle. They have been permanently differentiated, and they no longer can get into the cell cycle. The other types of muscles, striatum, cardiac, fit that. Also, neurons are permanent cells. You lose a neuron, it's gone. With the stem cell stuff now, it's possible to be able to get neurons in there now, potentially, because a stem cell research, and it can basically become whatever it wants. So we don't know where that's going. But permanent cells can't get into the cell cycle. So what's the only muscle that is not a permanent tissue? Smooth muscle. Now, see, the reason why you know this, have to know this, is the term hypertrophy and hyperplasia. Hyperplasia means an increase in number, hypertrophy in size. Would a permanent cell be able to undergo hyperplasia? No, because that means more copies of it. But could it potentially undergo hypertrophy? Yes. But it can't undergo hyperplasia. Can a smooth muscle cell undergo both hyperplasia and hypertrophy? Yeah, now you're catching on. Now you're catching on. There you go. These are little things that the bored people think about. They just sit around, they have one hand, the right hand, usually in a vice. Now someone that kind of goes in and they're in pain and they come up with these weirdo ideas when they're in pain to get students. Okay, that's how they make up questions best when they're being tortured. Okay. Now you learn that the most variable phase of a cell cycle is the G1 phase. Okay, women, what's your most variable phase of the menstrual cycle? Is it your proliferative phase? Or is it your secretory phase? What's your proliferative phase that can vary the most? Just stressed? Well, I'd be willing to bet that cycles are thrown off all over the place. And with stress, that's because your proliferative phase can be shorter or longer. But once you've ovulated, it's straight on from that. That doesn't change at all. So in other words, the proliferative phase would be kind of analogous to the G1 phase of the cell cycle, which can be shorter or lengthened in a cell. None of these other phases, S, G, 2, or M, they're written in concrete for that cell. So if I asked you, and like the boards would, if cancer cells, most of them have a longer cell cycle, in other words, it takes them longer to get through a cell cycle, what would be responsible for that? A longer G1 phase, there you go. Or if you had a cancer cell that had a shorter cell cycle than normal, then what would be the answer to that? A shorter G1 phase. See, I can put that into a clinical concept. G1 phase is kind of the mastermind of everything. Now, hopefully you learned about cyclin-dependent kinase. Okay, even though that's biochemistry, the term kinase, what does kinase always mean? Always. Phosphorylation. Okay, good. And phosphorylation usually involves sending a message to something. Activating something. Usually when you phosphorylate something, you activate something. Usually when you dephosphorylate something, you inactivate. Glucagon, I just learned this the other day, glucagon is a phosphorylator. Insulin is a dephosphorylator. That's why they're arch enemies. Okay? So glucagon is more likely to activate protein kinase, whereas insulin would dephosphorylate it and inactivate it. So remember, glucagon, phosphorylator, insulin, dephosphorylator. That's an interesting. Would that really help you, actually? I just learned that 2 days ago. Okay, so we have this thing, inactive cyclin D-dependent kinase. Well, who activates it? Well, cyclin D does. And who makes it? G1 phase makes cyclin D. Okay, so once cyclin D is made in the G1 phase, then it activates this enzyme, the cyclin-dependent kinase. Now it's active. Okay, you with me so far? All right, now, the key area in a cell cycle to control is from going from G1 to S phase. That's the absolute most critical area. Because if you had a mutation, and then you went into the S phase, and you duplicated it, then you have the potential for cancer. And so the real checkpoint, like we have in the security out here, I saw it in Newark, my God in heaven, I mean, it looked like I couldn't believe it. Jesus, boom. And so this is the key area right here. Okay, getting into the S phase, because if something that's a mutation gets into it, we run the risk of cancer. There are two suppressor genes that control this. The RB suppressor gene, chromosome 13, makes a protein called RB protein. What does it do? Prevents the cell from going from the G1 to the S phase. That itself was a board question right there. So, how do we get G1 phase to go into the S phase? Watch. That's that active cyclin D-dependent kinase phosphorylates the RB protein, and when it phosphorylates it, it can go from the G1 phase into the S phase. But it's a problem. Don't you see a problem? Is that good that it can go into the S phase? Well, yeah, for something that's divided. But what if there was a mutation? Would that be good? So who checks that enzyme, P53 suppressor gene? That's on chromosome 17. It makes a protein product that actually inhibits the cyclin D-dependent kinase. Now, can you see what that would do? What would that do? If I inhibited this kinase, what would happen to the cell? Would it be able to go into the S phase? Yes or no? Okay, so RB suppressor gene. Suppressor means suppressor, right? What are we suppressing? Its ability to go from the G1 into the S phase. You with me? So RB suppressor gene, we see, prevented it, didn't we? So did the P53 suppressor gene prevented it, because by blocking this enzyme, okay, we can't phosphorylate the RB protein that's going to remain in the G1 phase. The P53 suppressor gene is the number one most important gene for cancer, human cancer. Number one. Numero uno. Big time. In fact, the human papillomavirus, this is a neoplasia, don't start looking for it. Human papillomavirus inactivates the RB suppressor gene and the P53 suppressor gene. That's a nasty little virus, the human papillomavirus. Makes two gene products. Hopefully you even learn these in microbiology, E6 and E7. E6 knocks off the P53 and E7 knocks off the RB suppressor gene. That's incredible. All right, can you understand now, if I knock off, by, let's say, a point mutation, an RB suppressor gene, what's going to happen? Think. What did it normally do? It made an RB protein to prevent the cell from going into the S phase. So what's the answer? What's going to happen if you knock off the RB suppressor gene? No RB protein. What's to prevent it from going into the S phase? Nothing. Therefore, you run the risk of cancer. Could you name a couple? How about retinoblastoma, for which it stands? But what if you were a kid and you had some pain in and around your knee? What cancer would that be? Osteogenic sarcoma, Codman's triangle, sunburst appearance on X-ray, remember? If you're a woman, okay, and you had a breast cancer, RB suppressor gene can be involved in that too. So it's not just retinoblastoma that it's associated with. Depending on your age bracket, it hits you at different areas. So you can see then, by knocking off the RB suppressor gene, you can get cancer. How about knocking off the P53 suppressor gene? Okay, what would that mean? Well, that mean that kinase would always be active, and you'd always be phosphorylating the RB protein, and that means you'd always be going into the S phase. Would that be good? No. So if you knock off either one of those genes, then what happens at the G1 phase? Goes into the S phase. The P53 is actually called the guardian of the cell. I really like that term, because you know what really, why it inhibits it from going into the G1 phase? Let me tell you why it does it. It gives the cell time to detect if there are any abnormalities in DNA. No splicing defect, some codon thing, whatever. Okay? And so we have DNA repair enzymes, as you'll learn, that can splice out those abnormalities and correct it, and then the cell's all ready to go then into the S phase. If the cell has been damaged too much in its DNA, then it's actually removed by apoptosis. And so that's why it's such an important gene, because it gives the cell an opportunity to clean itself up DNA-wise before it gets before it goes into the S phase. Pretty clever. Okay, so these are the two very important genes that control the cell cycle. You are guaranteed a number of questions, maybe two, three, four questions related to this. Now, the S phase means synthesis phase. That's where everything's doubled. That includes DNA, chromosomes. So you're 4N at this point. You were 2N and G1. Now you're 4N. You're double. That double the chromosomes. Everything's doubled. If you were a muscle, you'd have double the number of contractile elements. Everything's doubled. G2 phase is where you make a tubulin. Tubulin is the protein from which you make the microtubule for the mitotic spindle. That's blocked by etoposide and by bleomycin. And then you have M for mitosis. Okay? And mitosis is where the cell divides into two N cells. And the cell can either go into a geo-resting phase, or the cell can continue going on in the cycle and divide again, or it could be permanently differentiated, depending on how it wants to go. Okay, very important. The students have problems, including me, with, you have to know the normal, otherwise you'll never understand this thing. If you knock off the RB suppressor gene, no RB protein, then there's nothing to prevent it from going into the S phase. Not good. And that one's easy. The one that's harder is the P53. The P53 suppressor gene normally makes a protein that inhibits this kinase, and that way you prevent the RB protein from being phosphorylated, then it stays in the G1 phase and gives the cell an opportunity to correct the DNA defects. So if you knock it off, then who's inactivating the kinase? Nobody. And so you end up constantly phosphorylating, and you constantly divide, 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 and you can end up with the potential for cancer. Okay? Very important. Very important. important. Now, where do zinc alkaloids work? Mitotic spindle, paclitaxel. Come on, guys, you had pharmacology. Come on, talk to me. Paclitaxel, end phase. Just watch where this thing is. I'll give you the answer, okay? Okay? Colchicine, etoposide, G2. Bleomycin, methotrexate. All right, S phase, good. Okay. Greasyl fulvin, M phase. Okay. Must know. Must know. Guys, they've done it already. They put the cell cycle up, and this is A, B, C, and D, and E. Okay? Then they mention a drug, and you have to figure it out. A patient has rheumatoid arthritis, is a macrocytic anemia. The drug responsible for this is located, does what, in what phase of the cell cycle? You answer it. The answer would be M, that'd be methotrexate, blocking dihydrofolate reductase. Whoa, that's how they do it? Yes. Why did they just say methotrexate? Where does it go? It's too easy. You can memorize it. So they'll give you a clinical scenario. Would you like another one? Kinda. All right. You got a HIV-positive person that has dyspnea into kidney and white out of the lung. He's put on a drug, and he ends up with cyanosis. And say, where would the drug have worked? Nowhere, because it's none of those drugs. Just thinking about it. That's all right. I didn't do that purposely. It's Datsun, and I don't know where I'm thinking about Datsun in this thing. But let me see another one. Okay, this drug used to be used in the treatment of acute gouty arthritis, but because of side effects, it's no longer used. Where would that one work? M-phase, what's the name of that drug? Colchicine, very good. Okay. This drug is a chemotherapy agent made from a yew tree. Not U, Y-O-U, Y-E-W. And it says paclitaxel. And that would be M phase. Okay. Vinca alkaloids are made from what? Some kind of, what are the vincas? Periwinkle plants. Okay. This is all stuff they ask on boards, guys. Okay, so you got to know these things. Cell cycle is very important for farm, for cell biology, for neoplasia. Must know. All right, last part of the cell injury are the different growth alterations. Big time important. Big time important. The first one I like to deal with is atrophy. First, know that the diagnosis is a decrease in tissue mass, and the cell actually decreases in size, and kind of it just has enough organelles in it to survive. So it has less mitochondria than normal, and it's just trying to eke it out until whatever it is that it needs to stimulate, it can come back. Okay? So when we think of atrophy, we have to think of a lot of different things. Okay? This is hydronephrosis, and know what's actually causing this thinning of the cortex and medulla? Well, it's compression atrophy. Okay? What's the most common cause of hydronephrosis? You can see that the pelvis is dilated. A stone in the ureter. Okay? But they could ask you something this simple. They can put this up and they'll say, what's the growth alteration in this slide? The answer is it's atrophy. Because of the increased pressure on the cortex and medulla, that's going to produce ischemia. The blood flow is going to decrease, and that's going to produce atrophy of the renal tubules. So it's an example of atrophy. Okay? All right, here's a brain. This is not a brain that you would want, okay, because it's got hills and dales in here. You'd like it to be all hills and no dales, okay? And this is an atrophied brain. Okay? And this could be atrophied because of atherosclerosis, which would be the most common, but also could be atrophied because you have knocked off the neurons in it in layers 3, 5, and 6. Anybody give me an example of that? Alzheimer's disease, where you have degeneration of neurons. Okay, neurons are cells, guys. If they get destroyed, remember the cerebral cortex has its neurons in layers 3, 5, and 6. They get destroyed. Wouldn't that reduce the overall mass of the brain? Sure. So atherosclerosis could be a cause. Alzheimer's disease can be a cause. Okay, related to the beta amyloid protein, which is toxic to neurons, and many other things causing that. This is muscle. Okay, and you can see this atrophy of the muscle here. Lots of things. Lou Gehrig's disease, amyotrophic lateral sclerosis. If you knock off the nerve to the muscle, you need nerve to constantly stimulate it so that it remains big, the muscle. And so it undergoes atrophy, or a leg in a cast. The one I like most, guys, though, is endocrine-related things. Okay, for if I have hypopituitarism, what would my adrenal gland look like? What part of my adrenal gland would be atrophied? Exactly, exactly. Cortex isn't good enough. Which layer of the cortex? Fasciculata and reticularis, that's right. Not the zona glomerulosa. Why is that? Because ACTH has nothing to do with stimulating aldosterone release. Vesiculata, remember, is where you make what? Cortisol, glucocorticoids, fasciculata. Reticularis is where you make sex hormones. That's your 17-ketosteroids, testosterone, right? Now, ACTH is responsible for stimulating those things, but not the zona. So you'd have atrophy of the vesiculata and reticularis. Guys, they already had a picture of the adrenal gland. And they had all the layers, A, B, C, and then they had medulla with D on it. And they asked all kinds of different questions. And you had to know which one of those were affected. Okay. So that's your histology, physiology, pathology integration, which they just love. If I'm taking thyroid hormone, what's happened to my thyroid gland? It's atrophied. Why? Because if I'm taking thyroid hormone, what is it doing to my thyroid-stimulating hormone? Decreasing it. I have nothing stimulating my gland. Therefore, it undergoes atrophy. There you go. Okay? All right. This was one on the boards right here. This, as they said, was a biopsy of the pancreas from a child with cystic fibrosis. And they said, what's the growth alteration present? Well, the answer is atrophy. Okay? I want you to look at these. These are tubules, and they're filled with this reddish stuff that's like concrete. Remember, in cystic fibrosis, when your cystic fibrosis transmembrane regulator on chromosome 7 is defective, then you can't, then you have problems with secretions. They become thicker. Okay? And so it blocks the ducts like these are doing. And so that means then that the glands which are making the fluids in the pancreas, the exocrine part, if you block the lumen, there's a back pressure on them. And just like we had atrophy of the renal cortex and medulla from a back pressure related to urine, the same thing happens if you block the lumen of a duct. You get atrophy of the glands. And this is why you get malabsorption in all children with cystic fibrosis. So the answer is atrophy. That's through a lot of students. Okay, here we have a aorta. Okay? And we have, right over here, we have the atherosclerotic plaque. Okay, so what's this kidney an example of? Atrophy. And what type of hypertension does this patient have? Renal vascular hypertension. What's the renin level coming out of this kidney, please? High. See? You should have been able to look at this and be able to know what's that growth alteration. In fact, if you knock this one off, then what? The other one's doing all the work. They could just as easily point to the other kidney and say what growth alteration is there. Hypertrophy. Or they can point to this one and say, what's the renin level coming out of the renal vein? Increased. What's the renin level coming out of the renal vein? Decreased. Suppressed. All kinds of things. Okay. But they like growth alterations. Or they can do this. They can point to this and say, the growth alteration noted in this patient is similar to a growth alteration in. And then you have to find some other cause of atrophy, another thing that's related to atrophy. So in other words, you have to know, that's an example of atrophy, and then they give you five choices, and you have to pick which one of those is also an example of atrophy. That's another way to do it. Maybe it could be one of these. Is that hard? Not really. But is it scary a little bit? Yeah. But now you know how they do it, don't you? So should it be as scary? Not when you already know how they do it, guys. I would not think so. Who should be scared? The people not taking this review. They have no idea what's on this test. They're looking at first aid for boards and stuff like that. You know, what do they say? You know, I'm just going to study first aid for boards. They ain't going to make it. It's not enough. Not enough high-yield stuff on first aid for boards to make it. Not enough. They have no idea what's on the test. They don't have any idea how the questions are asked. Do you? Oh yeah, you're gonna know by the end of Friday. You're gonna know all the little tricks, and they're all in your notes right there. Direct correlation. You read through page one to whatever the end is, you'll do extremely well. Unless you get nervous. All right, so what a growth alteration is this? Hypertrophy. And this is a picture of what hypertrophied muscle is. Now, how would I do this one? Well, I would look at this thing and I would say, okay, this is an example of, let's see, how would I do this? I might ask a question about what I would see. Maybe if I wanted to make this cell biology, I would say, what is the N of this? Just 2N? Well, let me give you a hint first. Okay? Hypertrophy of a cardiac muscle, which is a permanent muscle, the supposed block is before the G2 phase. Okay, so now what would be the answer? What would be the number of chromosomes in this one? Would this be a 2N, which is normal, a 1N, a 3N, or a 4N? 4N. Because if you block G2, just before G2, that's after the S phase, and everything's double, then this muscle cell here would be 4N. So you just say it. They'll say 1N, that would be something like a sperm, okay, which would be 23 chromosomes. Then they'll put 2N, that'd be a normal diploid cell. 3N, that would be really bad, because that means you probably have cancer or some trisomy disease. Okay, and then 4N would be the answer in this. You have double the number. That's right. So I can do any number of things with this. So hypertrophy is an increase in size of the cell, not number. Not number. We go further with this when we do cardiovascular. I play games with you. Hyperplasia, what is that definition? Number. It's an increase in number of cells. Okay? This is a normal proliferative gland. Okay? There's piles of mitoses all over the place here. And eventually what's going to happen is you're going to get endometrial mucosa kind of looking like that. So what's this an example of? Hyperplasia, because there's more of them. Okay, that's why it's called proliferative phase, guys. You're increasing the number of endometrial glands by increasing cell divisions. You're getting more cells dividing, more glands. Can you see why if you had unopposed estrogen, you can end up with cancer? Because if you didn't have progesterone to undo everything that estrogen did, you're going to get cancer. You're going to go from hyperplasia to atypical hyperplasia to endometrial cancer if you have unopposed estrogen. So that's a very important concept. Hyperplasia left unchecked, you run the risk for cancer. With one exception, lucky for us guys, this is the only good thing about prostate cancer. Prostate hyperplasia does not predispose to prostate cancer. So the worst thing you'll have is that you'll be getting up three times at night, like me. Okay? But I don't have to worry about prostate cancer deriving out of hyperplasia, because they're two different processes, hyperplasia and prostate cancer. That's the only exception I know of, though. Here's some more examples. This is a gravid uterus. That's a woman's uterus after she's delivered. This is an example of 50-50, 50% hypertrophy of the smooth muscle cells in the wall of the uterus, and 50% is related to hyperplasia. That's equal amount, both sides. This is a bone marrow. This would be a beautiful thing to throw at you. Okay. Normally, you should have three times as many white blood cells as red blood cells. Okay. Well, the only white blood cells I see are that one, and that one. All the rest of these are red blood cells. So my question would be, I'd say, this is a bone marrow aspirate from which of the following patients? Okay, so if there's an increase in RBCs, that's RBC what? Hyperplasia. Okay, would you expect to see that in iron deficiency? No, because you're lacking iron to make RBCs. Would you expect to see it in thalassemia? No. Why? Because you have a defect in making globin chains. Would you expect to see it in someone with chronic obstructive pulmonary disease? Yes. Because they have hypoxemia releasing a hormone. What would that hormone be, please? Erythropoietin. Where exactly is it made, please? I was on boards. It's made in the endothelial cell of the peritubular capillary. So this is a erythropoietin-stimulated marrow, guys. So they'd assume that you know it's RBC hyperplasia. Then it asks you a clinical scenario and say which one would it fit. Don't worry, you have questions in the questions I put down for you have things like that in it, so don't worry about it. I have all the examples of these things. Okay. What's this? Come on, guys. Everyone knows what this is on the elbow. Come on. Psoriasis. So this is a histologic section of psoriasis. See these little white silvery scales? That corresponds to this right over there. Does that look like normal skin? Say no. So what is psoriasis an example of? Hyperplasia. It's an unregulated peripheral proliferation of squamous cells in your skin. And so you get this raised red plaque with silvery scales on it corresponding to this excess in stratum corneum. It's hyperplasia. Unregulated. That's why methotrexate can work in it, because it's cell cycle specific to the ES phase, and it prevents the basal cells from proliferating. Ooh, I'm getting this. I'm getting this. I'm starting to get this. I hope so. We're only almost, what, 2 hours into this? Where are we? Three. You should start to get the idea of how they ask things. Now, that should either scare you or make you confident. Okay? It's one of the two. Most of you get scared. Say, oh, I didn't know that. But now you do. Think about what you know now. Yeah, I'd be scared if I didn't know what was on the test. I'd be less scared if I had some idea what was on the test. Ooh. Okay. Depending on what your makeup is. Unlike most of you, I get scared. But if I'm really, really studied up, I really didn't get too nervous about tests because I thought, well, what could they ask me that I haven't studied? I at least have half a chance. We didn't have board reviews when we took national boards either. Okay, now, this is a cool one, okay? This is the prostate gland, and that's the bladder. Okay? So this prostate gland probably looks like this. So what do you think the process is over here on the prostate gland? Hyperplasia. See, a lot of you think it's prostate hypertrophy because you had pathologists that don't know dork from dork sign out your prostate curettings. Any pathologist that writes prostate hypertrophy ought to go back to school again. It's not hypertrophy of glands and smooth muscles, it's hyperplasia. It's a hormone-related thing. All hormone-stimulated glands undergo hyperplasia, not hypertrophy. So you have hyperplasia of the prostate gland, but look at the wall of the bladder. It's too thick. Why is it too thick? Now think of it trying to get urine through this narrow opening in the urethra there. Think it's having to work. What happens to muscle when it works? Ah. So the bladder wall is thickened because of hypertrophy of smooth muscle cells related to an increase in afterload, concept in cardiovascular phys, and this is hyperplasia of the prostate gland with hypertrophy of the bladder wall related to smooth muscles. Wow. They wouldn't do that. Why do you think I put it up there? Oh, yeah, they could do that. Oh, yeah. The last one is, next to last, is metaplasia. Metaplasia is a replacement of one adult cell type by another. Okay, so here's an esophagus, part of stomach, and this is all ulcerated away. We take a section through where, right at the edge of this mucosa here, and we can see that there are mucus-secreting cells here and goblet cells. Is that what should be present in the lower esophagus, glandular cells? Yes or no? What should be there? Squamous, but they're glandular and mucus secreting. So is that, what's that an example of? Metaplasia, glandular, and it's got even a name. Name it. Barrett's esophagus. Did you know that Barrett's esophagus is a precursor for adenocarcinoma? And that adenocarcinoma, the distal esophagus, has surpassed squamous cell carcinoma of the mid-esophagus as the most common esophageal cancer in the United States. So gastroesophageal reflux disease is now the number one precursor for esophageal cancer. And instead of it being squamous, it's an adenocarcinoma. Time for a break.